Blog Talk Radio.
Very, very soon.
The state
State Department is calling the flotilla provocative. It's urging Americans not to take part. What's your response?
Well, I think we should turn that around a little and ask the State Department who's being provocative when a group of unarmed civilians, civil society, is going to a country that's been totally under siege, where the highest unemployment in the world is in Gaza, when they don't have sanitary water conditions, they don't have medicine, and you really have to ask, being occupied, which is the country that's really being provocative? And I think that's Israel, and of course the United States colludes in that because we give Israel $3 billion a year of our tax money to do this to the people of Gaza.
Now, you're Jewish. I'm seeing a lot of Jews here. Are there any non-Jews here?
25% of this vote, of the delegates on this vote, are Jewish, yes. And there's a reason for that, because we want to say to the world that the Israeli government does not speak in our name.
My name is Ray McGovern, and I've seldom met 35 closer friends now, and that are really eager to get on that vote to get to Gaza. What Barack Obama wants to avoid is having to decide, do I call Netanyahu and risk being rebuffed, as he is accustomed to doing, or do I just let these Americans suffer whatever fate awaits them at the hands of the Israeli Navy? Tough decision. That's why they're focusing on Greece, to make sure that we never leave here, lest he have to face that decision. Never, never ever was it our intention to sail into Israeli waters, okay? Gazan waters are Gazan waters under Israeli law, because they pretend not to be an occupying power anymore. So either we go into Gaza waters, where we cannot be intercepted under international law, or the Israelis say, well, no, we were only kidding about not occupying Gaza. We still occupy Gaza. Then the Israelis do have a right to interdict arms traffic. Now, you know, we're bearing letters, okay? My grandfather from Ireland, he was a letter carrier. So is my other grandfather. It's very much in my tradition. We're carrying letters. Now, what in God's name can letters, how can they, letters, these letters be considered a threat to the security of Israel?
I'm Medea Benjamin with the group Code Pink. I'm from Washington, D.C. This is not a provocation. This is following the footsteps of Dr. Martin Luther King. It's following the footsteps of Mahatma Gandhi, following the footsteps of Palestinians who resist nonviolently day after day. And it's been a great global tradition of standing up against injustice.
Six members of Congress have signed a letter asking the U.S. government to protect the passengers. What do you want from the White House, from Congress, from the State Department?
Well, first I want to say that when you look around here at representatives from other organizations, they have members of their parliament going with them. There is a member of the Spanish parliament here, European parliament here, Swiss parliament, Norwegian parliament, and they ask us, how many members of your Congress are going on this U.S. delegation? And I laugh because I'm so ashamed to even say, not only is there not one member going, but we didn't even bother asking any of them to come because we knew it would be impossible. It was hard enough to get six people to sign a letter that said that our government should protect us. We are U.S. citizens, you know. So it is so embarrassing when you see how far removed our government is compared to other governments around the world in standing up for what we say that we go to war for in Iraq or in Libya, people's basic human rights.
So we're on our way to a square where there's some protests taking place?
We're heading to the heart of the resistance here in Greece, in Athens right now, Syntagma Square.
So people have been gathering there daily?
The square is actually occupied. People, you'll see when we get down, they've set up a whole community. Each quadrant has tents set up. There's a media area, a healthcare area. And then the center of the plaza is where they have the assemblies every night. So there's a popular assembly every night. Basically a decision-making process about different agendas that they do. And right now they're dealing with the political position around this austerity measure that are going to be voted on Wednesday and preparing for the general strike on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Square, the epicenter of protests in Greece right now. And we're with Lisa Fidian, who's sort of the unofficial tour guide for Democracy Now! In activist hotbeds. You were with us in Copenhagen, gave us a tour there during the climate protests. And now tell us what's going on here.
As you can see, as we come down into the main center of the plaza, right across from the parliament is the popular assembly that's taking place right now. So what you have is folks from every walk of life that come to the center here in Athens, you know, all different ages, from all different professions, from classes, different political ideologies. They're all coming here to participate in this incredible democratic process. And I think I've seen as I come down here, you know, people take it very seriously. There's this voting process, they set their agendas, and it's in the heart of this incredible community that's been here for over a month, where you have medical areas, media areas, art areas, cultural areas, and then people that are camping out. And so every day this goes on, and each night, starting from anywhere between 7 and 9 till midnight or so, the plenary happens. And really on the strike, this is, you know, the center where a lot of the conflicts happened 2 weeks ago. And when the strike comes Tuesday and Wednesday, this will continue to be the center. Wednesday, the general strike is calling for people from all around Greece to come here to surround the parliament building. So you can only imagine what that's going to be like. So it's really an incredible moment here. And as you've seen talking to people in Greece, they have such great hope and such belief in what they're doing here, that it's really democracy.
Well, maybe I came here like everybody came. It was something like a spontaneous call on Facebook saying everybody who is upset with this situation, Greek, come to Syntagma Square at 6 o'clock. It was Wednesday, 25 of May. And I came to see what this thing is. And I thought that, like usually, we were going to stay here for 2 hours, look at each other, yell a little, maybe have a fight with the police and go back. But we are here over a month. Yesterday we have our birthday of 1 month. And we managed to make a small, self-organized community. It's not... Some people say it's a political movement. Okay, I don't know. Maybe it is. It's a demonstration. That's what it is. Everybody thinks that the political system in this country is very corrupted. So we don't follow any part, any political part. This square says, but political parts are out.
And this week there's a general strike being called?
Yes, for 48 hours. 48 hours. We already voted and posted on the internet to this government and to the police that we are peaceful, that we won't cause any troubles. Protect us, don't hit us. I hope they will do it because it's going to be bad for us, but worse for them. We know that.
We are so proud to be here at a time to see this incredible uprising of democracy in Greece and to be here in solidarity with you. And we know right now that Greece is being screwed by the IMF and the Europe.
Okay. Well, that's where that report ended. But you can check it out on Democracy Now! That was some of the best reporting they've done for a long time. Fort Calhoun, I wanted to
I just wanted to mention something before you move on. I find it interesting that they wanted all reporters off the flotilla and they're threatening reporters. It seems like there's a blackout in the general media about the flotilla. We hear nothing in this country.
Well, that's because of this. The country is dominated by Jewish media.
And the mainstream media. We don't
never,
hear anything at all about the flotilla to Gaza. No.
All we get is internet updates like this from alternative news. And you can also go to US flotilla to Gaza.org.
Or the struggle.
elliotstruggle.org, and you'll get information, most current information. I wanted to read this one here. Apparent sabotage of against the Gaza flotilla.
Okay, so let's listen to this.
This was actually from Christian Science Monitor. I thought it was interesting. Apparent sabotage against Gaza flotilla. The Giuliano, a boat planning to join the Gaza flotilla, challenging Israel's blockade, was sabotaged in a Greek harbor earlier today, according to a spokesman. There's no video to this. I'm just going to read it.
Okay.
It's not that long, but a ship jointly owned by Swedish, Greek, and Norwegian activists hoping to join a flotilla of activist vessels challenging Israel's economic blockade of Gaza had its propeller cut while in Athens Harbor today. A spokesman contacted by the monitor said that the damage was a deliberate act of sabotage.
Israel and its allies have been working hard to head off the planned flotilla, which is hoping to enter the waters of Gaza in the next week. Colonel retired Ian Wright, who is organizing a U.S. vessel named the Audacity of Hope for the flotilla, says her ship has been detained in Athens on spurious charges that it's not seaworthy. She says the charge was made by an Israeli legal group. Now the Giuliano is held up. Mikhail Lofgren, a spokesman for Ship to Gaza, Sweden, says the damage was discovered at 6:30 in the evening Athens time today, and that dive has probably cut the propeller in the past 24 hours. The reports I'm receiving is that it's certain that it was sabotaged, says Mr. Lofgren, reached by phone in Sweden. The propeller and the propeller shaft has been cut, and we had divers that have filmed the damages. Experts have said there's no doubt the damage was deliberate.
He says that repairing the damage will take a few days. As to who was responsible, he declined to speculate. We simply don't know who did it, but it's obviously a hostile act, said Lofgren. Israel has been desperate to stop the flotilla from nearing Gaza, and Israel raided a similar flotilla in international waters last year, killing 9 pro-Palestinian activists in the process, one of them an American citizen. In the wake of that event, the international outcry against Israel eased some of the restrictions on the flow of goods into Gaza.
This year, Israel is determined it doesn't get that far. Oops.
Sorry.
Earlier today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet approved using any means necessary to stop the flotilla from reaching Gaza. The U.S. has been putting pressure on the activists to hold back. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton characterized the flotilla as hostile in a comment last week. We think it's not helpful for there to be flotilla that tried to provoke action by entering into Israeli waters and creating a situation in which the Israelis have the right to defend themselves, Clinton said. Defend themselves is ridiculous.
Yeah,
they don't even have anything to defend.
And it's Gaza waters. It's not Israeli waters.
The flotilla, in fact, says it has no plans to enter Israeli waters, instead planning on transiting through international waters to Gaza's territorial waters. The distinction goes to the heart of their protest. While Israel extends de facto sovereignty over Gaza's coastal waters, penning its fishermen close to shore and preventing any shipping or ferries to run to and fro the strip, it's not their territory under international law. The activists themselves say they want to make that point peacefully. Coming and going from Gaza shouldn't be criminalized, insist that they will practice nonviolence in their attempt, and that they'd be delighted to simply sail through unmolested.
There you go. And
so there we have it, and that's what the standoff is all about. But I'm very disgusted at Hillary Clinton's statement.
Oh, I'm just disgusted at the entire foreign sector of our national, our government. It sucks. It just sucks rocks. Cowards. They won't even defend their own people against is a belligerent nation. Absolutely ridiculous. There's something else I wanted to mention tonight on the Middle East. I thought this was interesting because Kerry and McCain both went over there. And they're such hypocrites. I mean, they're such assholes. They're the worst. And I wanted to bring that up again. I'll get to that in a minute. It's here somewhere. Anyway, I got one more that I wanted to read. It's a brief one that I wanted to read on Palestinian solidarity. It says, criminalizing Palestinian solidarity. The campaign against Israel apartheid has resulted in 23 Palestinian solidarity activists facing U.S. federal grand jury. The U.S. government, this was filed yesterday by the U.S. state's government has criminalized the Palestinian people and now is increasingly threatening U.S. citizens who stand in solidarity with Palestine as criminals as well, including those courageously putting their lives on the line to break the siege on Gaza. I am a Palestinian solidarity activist in the U.S. and one of 23 U.S. citizens who has been issued with a subpoena to appear before a grand jury as part of what the government has said is an investigation into violations of the laws banning material support to foreign terrorist organizations. None of us have given money or weapons to any group in the State Department foreign terrorist organization list. But what many of us have done is participate in or help organize educational trips to meet with Palestinians and Colombians resisting the U.S.-funded military regimes they live under. The goal of these trips is to learn about the human rights violations happening in these places and to bring those stories back home to the U.S., to educate people, and to organize to change U.S. foreign policy for the better.
Travel for such purposes should be protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. But a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project to dramatically expand the government's definition of what constitutes material support for a foreign terrorist organization. Now the government considers travel to places like the West Bank and Colombia to be a predicate or a justification for opening up an investigation and issuing search warrants to raid activists' homes and seize their belongings. Political speech, if made in a coordinated way, can be construed as material support. Travel to Colombia was the initial pretext for the investigation into the 23 of us, but it expanded to travel to Palestine. This was confirmed with the recent discovery of files accidentally left behind by the FBI in one of the homes raided last September. The file includes dozens of questions that the FBI wanted to pose to activists, many of them focused on travel to Palestine and Colombia. Two asking activists to name every person they know who has ever traveled to the Middle East or South America. Civil liberties groups, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, have decried Holder versus HLP because it imposes guilt on people by association and criminalizes activities like distribution of literature, engaging in political advocacy, participating in peace conferences, training in human rights advocacy, and donating cash and humanitarian assistance, even when this type of support is intended only to promote lawful and nonviolent activities. The investigation into 23 of us is viewed by many as a test case for Holder versus HLP. Conviction of a violation of the material support laws means a prison sentence of up to 15 years, and what happens with our case will set a precedent for many social justice movements in the U.S., but it will particularly and perhaps more immediately impact Palestinian solidarity activists who campaign to end U.S. aid to Israel and in support of the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Palestine solidarity movement in the U.S. is at risk. Solidarity movement has gained significant ground in the U.S. in the past few years. Consciousness of the oppressive nature of the Israeli apartheid regime has been raised in the wake of Israel's 2006 war on Lebanon, when the phrase Dayahei doctrine was coined to describe Israel's wholesale destruction of civilian infrastructure. The winter of 2008 and 2009 invasion and air attacks on the trapped civilian population of the Gaza Strip further exposed Israel's cruelty and the execution of 9 humanitarians aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla last year show that Israel knows no bounds and that the impunity it enjoys needs to end before the next massacre is perpetrated. Activists in the U.S. play a key role in efforts to bring Israel's war crimes and occupation to an end as the U.S. government bankrolls the Israeli military and our tax dollars and
with our tax dollars
and shields Israel from accountability through diplomatic bullying and the veto of the U.N. Security Council. For these reasons, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in the U.S., while still young, is especially significant. The movement is rooted in a rights-based approach and aimed to compel Israel to respect international law. Such efforts to hold Israel to account are viewed as enough of a threat that the U.S. State Department this month reiterated its commitment to counter head-on efforts of delegitimization regarding Israel. Our diplomatic engagement with Israel in multilateral affairs is rooted in a core commitment by President Obama. The State Department's Esther Brimmer told Zionist think tank Washington Institute for Near East Policy. President Obama and this administration have worked tirelessly in both word and deed across the UN system to ensure that Israel's legitimacy is beyond dispute and that Israel has the opportunity to contribute fully to its institutions to which it belongs, she added. Now, what a crock that is.
Siege-breaking activists may be next. It is U.S. policy to block Palestinians from all avenues to justice at the U.N. level by foiling the Goldstone Report on war crimes in the Gaza Strip or preventing any censure of Israel for last year's massacre of flotilla activists. But this week, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has given Israel the green light to attack the second Gaza Freedom Flotilla.
What a bitch. Would you want that whore in your...
Oh, thank God.
You know, in charge of your... And, oh, my God. You know, I mean, can you imagine that heartless bitch?
The State Department also issued a statement on the second flotilla, which will include approximately 50 Americans, in which it warned that delivering or attempting or conspiring to deliver material support or other resources to or for the benefit of a designated foreign terrorist organization such as Hamas could violate U.S. civil and criminal statutes and could lead to fines and incarceration. Hamas, which is the ruling party in the Gaza Strip and which won a majority of seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council elections in 2006, is on the U.S. State Department's unilateral foreign terrorist organization list, along with every other major Palestinian political party besides Fatah, though its armed wing is on the list. This means that the U.S. has essentially criminalized the entire Palestinian people and the parties which represent them, except for those that collude with the Israeli occupation. The State Department's foreign terrorist organization list is a politically motivated register, not reviewed by any court, and inclusive of pretty much every liberation movement resisting regimes bankrolled and supported by the United States. Prosecution for violators of the material support law is also blatantly political. Former Attorney General Michael McCaskey, John Afcroft's successor, former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, and a former Homeland Security Secretary and National Security Advisor, are, as far as I know, not being investigated for material support for foreign terrorist organizations after they spoke in support of an Iranian opposition group on the State Department's list at a conference organized by the group last year.
Obama on the wrong side of history. It is also not lost on any of the 23 of us whose freedom is on the line that had this material support statute been in place when President Obama was an anti-apartheid campus divestment activist, he too would have been vulnerable to prosecution. At the height of the South Africa apartheid movement, the U.S. State Department designated as a foreign terrorist organization the African National Congress, the party led by Nelson Mandela. He founded its armed wing, and which guided the solidarity movement in the U.S. Mandela was only removed from U.S. terrorism watch list in 2008 at age 99. And now that the international movement to bring apartheid in Palestine to an end has claimed more and more victories, Israel finds itself increasingly isolated, just as the U.S. was amongst the last to support apartheid in South Africa. It will be among the last to support apartheid in Palestine up to the bitter end, and those who oppose it will face an increasing backlash. While President Obama, who wrote the introduction to Mandela's most recent autobiography, what a joke, was on the right side of history when it came to apartheid in South Africa, he is on the wrong side of today's apartheid struggle. Furthermore, U.S. citizens who have dedicated their lives to fighting for what is right are being criminalized on his watch. This was by Maureen Claire Murphy, managing editor of the electronic Infantata and Palestine Solidarity activist based in Chicago. You can follow her on Twitter at Maureen underscore 70. So this is a long article, but it was very, very important.
And that was
published on Ukrnet.info. Okay, which is foreign
press.
Middle East press.
Not, of course, published anywhere.
Published on MySpace, on Facebook by L.A. Steele, on Leo Steele's, on my Facebook.
On your maybe you could, what is the next article that we're thinking of?
Anyway, let's see. This was quick, but this is the Irish Ship to Gaza.org. And it's it's a bunch of guys, rugby players.
They're on that flotilla also.
Yeah, they're on the Irish Ship to Gaza. And here we go. So this is good. It's short, but it's good. Stay Human is the name of the group.
My name is Gordon Darcy. I support Freedom Flotilla 2. My name is John Fogarty. I support Freedom Flotilla 2.
My name is Trevor Hogan. I support Freedom Flotilla 2.
My name is Owen Redden. I support Freedom Flotilla 2.
I'm calling for an immediate end to Israeli siege on Gaza.
The flotilla is a human rights initiative funded by hundreds of thousands of ordinary people like you across the world. Please show your solidarity by donating now to the Irish Ship to Gaza at www.irishshiptogaza.org.
Stay human.
Stay human. Stay human. Stay human.
That was sent to IrishShipToGaza.org. That was sent to me by Livewar von Schoenau, who is one of the
activists.
One of the activists that are on the Palestinian is going to on the boat to Gaza.
On the American ship, on the
with
the American group of activists.
Right.
This is the Irish group. They're looking to raise money, apparently.
Right, but he sent that over to me so that I would be able to post it as well. And, I've got some health issues coming up that I want to talk about later in the show, but we still got some time. And this one, this one's kind of strange. And not only this one, but the one I got coming up about, it's a little long, it's a little segment about from Ben Bernanke, talking about the collapse of the economy. All right.
The collapse of the American or worldwide?
World economy, but the American economy, too. Press TV goes on. This article isn't very long, but it's appropriate. Eurozone on verge of economic collapse.
Billionaire George Soros says Europe's debt crisis has brought the Eurozone to the brink of an economic collapse. Inevitably, some of its members will leave the union. And they'll be better off because they'll have their own coins, I hope.
Probably.
There's no arrangement for any countries leaving the euro, which in current circumstances is probably inevitable, Soros said at a panel discussion in Vienna, Austria, on Sunday, Bloomberg reported. He added, we're on the verge of an economic collapse, which starts, let's say, in Greece, but it could easily spread. the financial system remains extremely vulnerable. I think most of us actually agree that Europe's crisis is actually centered around the euro, the 80-year-old investor added. It's kind of a financial crisis that is really developing. It's foreseen. Many people realize it. It's still developing. The authorities are actually engaged in buying time. Yet time is working against them, he said. The comments come as Greek politicians are debating a new round of austerity measures tied to the country's bailout. A vote is expected on Wednesday in widespread protests against plans to further slash the public sector and hike taxes. Greece was the 12th country to adopt the shared currency in 2001, while Estonia is the newest member of the euro region, joining in January 2011.
But Soros says it's coming.
And many wealthy Americans have invested in the euro as a way to escape our plunging dollar.
Which is stupid because the euro is going under too.
Yeah.
They're the first to go. So.
I'm interested in a way, you know, we haven't heard a thing about Iceland, remember? They kind of.
Oh, no, because they're doing so well. You know, they don't want, nobody is.
They bailed out of the European help and said, we'll toss out our bankers and we're not giving our taxpayers money to bail out your problems.
Yeah.
And so they went out on their own. They're doing just fine. They have their own bank.
That's right. And I wanted to bring this one up, too, because this is following up the Greek Union stage mass strike. From the Financial Times, Europe edition. Greek Union staged massive strike. Mass strike. Greece, I'm sorry, these things here.
Get some pop-ups, that's all.
Yeah. And then they make you register to get to the, I hate this. So many games they play with you. They tempt you with a good article and then they fake you out. You have to sign in. Get the page you want.
Okay, so just bear with us. Be a little patient. We're getting the article on the from the Financial Times.
Yeah, it's so short.
It's a short article. It's a little follow-up on the latter half of what we paid from Democracy Now! Remember the people going to the square to oppose this austerity measure? Just click on that one. Click on the picture.
Greece faces suicide blow on austerity measure. 54-second thing here. Greece will be committing suicide if its parliament fails to back sweeping austerity measures aiming at averting a catastrophic default, according to the head of the country's central bank. Stark warning of George Provopoulos, governor of the Bank of Greece, further heightened the stake ahead of a knife-edge vote on Wednesday in the Greek parliament. It came as Athens police fired. It came as Athens police fired tear gas after protesters at the severity of the measures imposed by the European Union and International Monetary Fund turned violent. Speaking to the Financial Times, Mr. Provopoulos expressed concern that Greece's economic crisis had been played down by politicians over the past 18 months as the country lurched toward the possible default.
We have never really had a debate in this country about what went wrong. In Portugal, the new government has come in and said there will be a difficult 2 years ahead. We have not had that kind of talk here, he said. He added, for Parliament to vote against this package would be a crime. The country would be voting for its suicide. Turning up the heat, Olli Rehn, the EU's top economic official, dismissed German suggestions that the Eurozone was contemplating a plan B in case the Greek parliament fails to approve the austerity cuts. The future of the country and financial stability in Europe are at stake, Mr. Mr. Wren said, I trust the Greek political leaders are fully aware of the responsibility that lies on their shoulders to avoid default. The Greek Parliament's approval of £28 billion package for tax increases and spending cuts is crucial to securing a second international bailout to replace the £110 billion program agreed to a year ago.
Okay. What I wanted to do is that's enough for that one. It's on Financial Times, if you're interested. But what I wanted to do is go to the one I have set up here. Bernanke's talk. I don't know if I thought I had posted that, but maybe not. This talk's about, this is quick, but it's a Kucinich's talk on raising the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm. That's in this country.
Yeah, today I took the House word to remind fellows of something that founders did not intend for America to be run by big banks and Wall Street.
Absolutely.
Without objection. Why are we in debt? We borrow trillions for wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, trillions for tax cuts for the rich. We borrow billions from China and Japan. We have plenty of money for war, Wall Street, and welfare for the wealthy. But when millions of honest Americans need jobs, need wage increases, need health care, need education, need retirement security, they're told, no, we don't have the money. How is it that the Fed can create trillions of dollars to give to the banks, but the U.S. can't meet its needs without going into debt to banks? The financial system works for a few at the expense of the many. The founders did not intend for America to be run by big banks and Wall Street. The Constitution put the ability to create money in the hands of Congress. The Fed took away that power in 1913. We need to get that power back to invest in our economy, to create jobs, to put America back to work, to rebuild America without going into debt. We must reclaim our destiny by reclaiming control over the money system.
The gentleman.
He's right.
Yep. They try to get him off as fast as they can.
I wanted to do a test.
He heads up the financial committee, though, there in Congress. I don't know exactly which one.
Ron Paul does. I don't know he may be on that committee.
Oh, that's right. It's Ron Paul that heads up that.
Was
Kucinich.
Sorry. I'm going to move away from that for a minute. I've got a couple more things I wanted to read. This one here. From bradblog.com, and voting rights activist, but a political blogger, and we've had him on our show a number of times. But
he does a great job.
Yeah, but this one here, Brad on KPFD, GOP stabilizing country to regain power, with journalist Robert Perry. As leading Democrats finally begin to say out loud what many of us have observed for years, that the GOP is dead set on sabotaging the U.S. economy, and the U.S. with it, in order to regain the White House. I spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry about his recent article, Making the U.S. Economy Scream, on my KPFK Pacifica radio show today. Over the past several decades, Republican methods for winning national power have come to resemble CIA techniques for destabilizing an enemy country. Through the use of black propaganda, political skullduggery, and economic disruptions, Perry argues rather convincingly in his article, which is also cross-posted at Alternet under the title The GOP CIA Playbook, Destabilize Country to Sweep Back into Power. So with the GOP doing what they've done now for years, placing party far ahead of country, and as Perry explains, mirroring strategies used in the past to take down foreign nations like Chile, who is really to blame for the destruction they continue to wreak, and them, the media for enabling them, the Democrats for having no apparent strategy to counter them, or the American public for being gullible enough to fall in fall for it time and time again. And
in my conversation with Terry today,
all of the above,
and a few words about Obama's drawdown from Afghanistan follows below.
And there is, and he has a download. You can download this.
It's about 27 minutes, so it's quite long.
Yeah, but
half hour.
But anyway, he talks about that, and it's worth going to. He writes, and he's an interesting reporter. And bradblog.com.
Yeah, go to bradblog.com, and you too can listen to that as a half-hour report.
Now, here's the biggest piece of work I've ever come across. His name happens to be Clarence Thomas. All right.
You remember him?
Yeah.
The Supreme Court Justice.
Yeah.
The one who harassed women yet got on the Supreme Court anyway.
Right. Well, bradblog's got another article on him here. What happened recently? The judicial insider trading of Justice Clarence Thomas and wife Ginny. Okay. He had inappropriate sexual entanglements with a number of women and lied about it repeatedly to the American people. Yet nobody, save for one Colorado law school professor, seems to be calling for Justice Clarence Thomas's resignation for some reason. That, even though Thomas, unlike Representative Anthony Weiner, appears to have actually and flagrantly and repeatedly broken the law. As we reported in January, Thomas appears to have knowingly and willfully filed falsified financial disclosure forms, which withheld disclosure of nearly $700,000 his wife received from the right-wing Heritage Foundation for the better part of the last 20 years. And only once it was pointed out publicly this year did Thomas bother to file self-initiated amendments to the forms he had signed just above the legal warning in bold and caps, which read, "Note, if any individual who knowingly and willfully falsifies or fails to file this report may be subject to civil and criminal sanctions." All right.
While there has been little indication that law enforcement is actually investigating the crimes of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, which, as we pointed out in January, are punishable by up to $50,000 and 1 year in jail for each instance of falsification, last Friday, when Thomas's financial disclosure form for 2010 was released, the matter appears to have gotten shadier still, leading at least one government watchdog organization to describe what Thomas and his wife, Virginia Ginny Thomas, may be doing as a judicial insider trading. Connecting the dots, it would seem that the couple made huge profits from Thomas's participation and insider knowledge of last year's Citizens United ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court, as we'll show you below. While Barack Obama's DOJ seems to be looking the other way, that's Department of Justice, there was one person in Congress trying to bring attention to the issue last week with his ConflictedClarence.com website, Representative Anthony Weiner.
Ooh.
Now, isn't that interesting?
That's very interesting.
For some reason or another.
It was a right-wing blogger that brought this up, and Clarence, of course, is Mr. Right-Wing.
Weiner, has been detracted of late, so I was happy to pick up the ball today and cover the new Thomas disclosure on a radio show on LA's Pacific Radio affiliate, KPFK, today. The audio from the show is below, but here are a few quick details as promised. Before posting the timeline, one very important point that hasn't received nearly enough attention during Thomas's contentious confirmation hearing in 1991, he received a huge boost when an outside organization ran $100,000 worth of television commercials attacking those senators who were threatening to vote against Thomas's confirmation. The organization, a newly formed group called Citizens United. 20 years later, and without either Thomas disclosing it or anyone in the media connecting the dots, Thomas decided in favor of the group in the now infamous Citizens United versus the FEC case, which allowed a tsunami of corporate money into our political and electoral system. It was that decision that allowed corporations to pour virtually unlimited money into 501c4 nonprofits that could in turn use the money to affect elections with millions of dollars in campaign ads. Ginny Thomas created one of those 501c4 organizations just after oral arguments were argued before her husband in Citizens United case, somehow managed to raise some $550,000 in about 2 months' time before the end of 2009. Here, courtesy of Velvet Revolution's ProtectOurElections.org campaign. And it has a list of all the things that they've done.
Right.
It's quite, well, it's not all that long, but this is kind of a long article. Very good.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
I guess it is.
Yeah, it's very, very long.
Okay.
But that's real sleazy.
Let's just see what this says. It's only 3 minutes. I don't know. It's on this, but it's audio on Larry Stone's wife, Jenny Fake, AstroTurf.
Protect Our Elections has been digging hard into the fact that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas had failed to disclose his wife's income for 20 years, and also looking into Virginia Thomas being involved in conservative activism that may pose ethical conflicts. In 2009, she formed Liberty Central, a Tea Party conservative advocacy organization, and for the address for her organization and for herself as principal officer, she listed 5765-F, Burke Center Parkway in Burke, Virginia, on the 990 form to the IRS. Jenny Thomas would use the website for such things as posting a letter calling for the repeal of the health care law because it is unconstitutional, knowing full well her husband will most likely have to render a decision on this issue. In November of 2010, facing widespread criticism and under pressure, she supposedly stepped down from her position at Liberty Central, and they announced that it would merge with the Patrick Henry Center. But Protect Our Elections has uncovered in fact it was all a ruse, and when the dust settled and the press went away, Jenny Thomas immediately set up shop again, a consulting group called Liberty Consulting Incorporated. On their website, they state their office is in Burke, Virginia, 5765-F, Burke Center Parkway, Suite 302, the same suite as Liberty Central. Protect Our Elections wanted to get a comment from Liberty Consulting, Inc., so we proceeded to 5765-F, Burke Center Parkway, Suite 302, in Burke, Virginia. When we got there, we were confused as to why this address led to a UPS store. When we attempted to locate Suite 302, we discovered that, in fact, there is no Suite 302 and no offices. As it turns out, it's a P.O. box.
Are you videotaping our mailbox?
What suite number is it again?
Suite 302.
Are you videotaping our mailbox?
So this is the office right here?
Are you trying to find out about the mailbox, or are you trying to find out about
I'm trying to find out if you can use the mailbox.
You know what, guys? I'm sorry. I'm going to talk to you.
Certainly.
Have a great day.
Yeah.
Protect Our Elections believes that Liberty Consulting, Inc. is not only Liberty Central in disguise and a P.O. Box deception, but represents what plagued our 2010 elections. Fake AstroTurf organizations putting up a five-page website and a P.O. Box, all to funnel millions of dollars to influence elections and legislation, money from donors they don't have to reveal. We call for immediate criminal and ethical investigations to take place surrounding these allegations, and we demand that Clarence Thomas gets the equal justice under law that everyone else got that came before him seeking justice.
They have signed a petition demanding investigation and impeachment. Please visit protectourelection.org.
That might be an important thing for people to sign.
Right, protectourelections.org.
But he's been ensconced in that court for 10 years.
Yeah, more. Almost.
More than 10?
Yeah, 10, 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, 10 years.
10 years.
Seems,
yep.
It seems longer than that. Huh?
Yeah,
no, 91. No, 20 years.
20 years. 20 years?
20 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing, huh? Just amazing. So, anyway, that's some big news. I do have one more video I wanted to play for you. short one before we go to Woody in the Ring. It's about 8 minutes long. I don't know if...
It's a little bit long.
But this... I thought this was rather good because what it was is war is a racket, war from the inside the belly of the beast. Somebody, it tells you, this guy who's seen it, who understands war, was a higher up in the whole thing, is saying that war is only for
you're doing the bidding of corporations.
Only
that's
for
all
corporations.
You're doing.
And
if they want an army, they should get people, not volunteers from our country, but get an army of somebody else.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Washington, and we continue our series of interviews with Lawrence Wilkerson in the first segment of the interview. We talked about how Larry joined the American military and went to Vietnam for, as he said, fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. We pick up our story, and we're joined again by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So, you come back from Vietnam. What's the next big moment in your life in terms of your political understanding, your formation, and how you look at the world?
I went through the normal things that you do when you come back, anticipating going back in a year, only to be again sidestepped from that by the fact that I was selected to go to a very prestigious school.
Because you're sort of, I guess, somewhat unique. You're an intellectual and a soldier. There's only a few of those.
Well, the next moment in my life that was, as you're referring to, was at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, where I was introduced to Von McCraig, Clausewitz's seminal book on war, and introduced to a team of professors who more or less stripped war of its truth, justice, and the American way and gave it its real face, not just in terms of the battlefield. All of us in those seminars were Vietnam veterans, whatever service, and it included CIA and State Department personnel too, but also stripped it of its, shall we say, particularly in America, its hyperbole, its passion, its you've got to do this for the country, you've got to defend the shores and so forth, and boiled it down to its basics. This is all about politics and power. This is all about getting your way over someone else or someone else, plural, who wants to prevent you from getting your way, whether it's territory, whether it's resources, whether it's a way of belief, ideology, or whatever. That's what war is really all about. It's not about truth and justice. It never has been, never will be.
And they want you to understand this because you in this class are going to have to execute a foreign policy that actually works.
You are going to have to bring that educational experience, that knowledge, that skill you've developed, that critical thinking ability to problems at a much higher level now. You're not going to be leading a 42-man or woman platoon. You're going to be making policy yourself. You're going to be developing war plans yourself. You're going to be planning for these things. You're going to be dealing with politicians. You're going to be dealing with presidents and vice presidents and secretaries of state and defense and so forth. And so you've got to understand this. An interesting thing happens here. Fully half, if not slightly more, of the seminars usually won't accept this. They want to go back to flying their airplanes, sailing their ships, and commanding their battalions. And generally speaking, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force recognizes this somewhat incoherently and acknowledges it and does it. That is to say, those who accept the new responsibility and the new understandings move on up to be general officers. Those who don't stay where they are, peter principle out, and go to 20 and retire or whatever. It's not a very perfect thing, though. Lots of times you get people who come up who don't understand what's being taught them, and they go on and take their peter principle aspect right on into being a general, which is usually catastrophic for the person and for the people that serve that person.
In an interview we did a few months ago, you talked about how foreign policy is really about serving commercial interests. And it's the commercial imperative is the underpinning beginning of foreign and military policy. When go back to these seminars when they're stripping away truth, justice, and the American way, to what extent do you understand that, or is it just more about learning how to be pragmatic?
It's more about learning how to be pragmatic, but it's clearly geared to whatever entity, whatever national entity you're serving. It's not like Clausewitz is limited to America. I suggest that Sandhurst, the British schools would be a little bit different. The French schools would be a little bit different. The American schools are a little bit different. I think there's a clear understanding in the American schools that commerce, trade, is a big part of what a soldier is all about. That is to say, there is some aspect of Smedley Butler's I Never Fought a War that wasn't commercial purposes that every military officer realizes. There's a different aspect to it, though, when you bring other aspects of power to bear on the problem. Nuclear weapons, for example, you're not going to contemplate using nuclear weapons, or no one in his sane mind is going to contemplate nuclear weapons for commercial purposes. Nor is anyone going to probably contemplate deploying core-sized formations, army-sized formations out strictly for commercial purposes. There's got to be some other reason. So what do leaders do when they understand this? They conjure up a Saddam Hussein. They conjure up weapons of mass destruction. They conjure up connections between al-Qaeda and Baghdad. They conjure these things so that the unwashed American public will feel passionate and ideological about the reasons that they're sending increasingly fewer and fewer of their sons and daughters to die for state purposes. And so it becomes something that you grasp, deal with as a senior military officer, or it becomes something, and I've seen this happen, that repels you and you wind up leaving. You wind up leaving the service because you see this is not at all about truth, justice, and the American way. It's all about achieving the power purposes of a certain coterie of leaders who happen to be, by ballot box, occupying Washington for the time being.
All right, back into this seminar. You're now, some of the veil is lifted, and you're looking at more of the reality of war and the objectives of war. What's next for you?
The next thing for me was to become one of those teachers and to try to do what I could to help the services and differentiate.
Now you're an intellectual. You could have left. You could have gone into an academic stream, which many years later you do.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you? Why'd you stay?
Primarily because I really liked the Naval War College and what they were doing. I thought they were doing an excellent service for the nation to give this kind of education to future leaders. Because part of this education also is a recognition of the civil-military relationship and a fundamental recognition that civilians country serve. And to reverse that relationship would be tantamount to overthrow the republic. And
that was you can check that out on Brass Check TV, a Facebook site.
And now we're going to go to the introductory music for Woody. So let's hear that.
Thank you, Lila. How's the reception tonight? All right?
You sound pretty clear. We're just turning it up a bit. Go right ahead.
Great. Thank you. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NBA like NFL, David dies, David of David and Goliath, LT not worried about PT, NFL strike news, Tiger not looking ferocious, and, of course, baseball talk. All right, let's get down to it. NBA owners could have given the go-ahead for a Friday lockout when they met today in Dallas, but they did not. During the Board of Governors meeting, owners will receive an update on the stalemated negotiations from Commissioner David Stern and Spurs owner Peter Holt, head of the Owners Labor Relations Committee. Currently at an impasse over major economic issues, the two sides have no plans to meet in Dallas, and Commissioner David Stern has said that the owners' vote could be done electronically at any time before the CBA expires on Thursday at midnight. The CBA meaning collective bargaining agreement. Seeking major changes in a way money is divided with the players, along with securing a more favorable split for its side, a majority of the owners is said to be in favor of shutting down the league. Owners and players have made almost no progress during the last 18 months of talks. They're scheduled to meet tomorrow and possibly Thursday in Manhattan, but neither side is hopeful of an 11th-hour breakthrough. Kind of sad considering we had such a great NBA playoff. The games are real good, and the series were somewhat interesting. Even though LA got knocked out, it was still they drew a lot of viewers, and it was nice to see Miami get shut down and see Dallas win their first championship. It would be too bad if the NBA kind of follows suit with the NFL and maybe doesn't have a season next year. Because certain players are starting to merge and teams are starting to merge, making the league more interesting and more watchable again. So it would be a shame if they're not able to get together and figure something out. Again, it's one of those deals where billionaires and millionaires are fighting over, money. I don't know. I don't know whether a deal's going to get done or not. We'll just have to wait and see much everything else that goes on. Okay. The man who scored the most memorable basket in the NCAA tournament history was killed in an accident while driving a bus yesterday in North Carolina. Lorenzo Charles died in driving a company bus in Raleigh, with no passengers aboard, said Brad Jackson, general manager of the Elite Coach Bus Company. Charles, 47, scored the winning dunk off a missed 30-footer from Derek Wittenberg to lift decided underdog North Carolina State and coach Jim Valvano to the 1983 championship 54-52 over the heavily favored University of Houston in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Wittenberg, who went on to coach at Wagner and Fordham, took the heave that Charles converted into one of the most improbable scenarios in all of sports. Valvano came like racing onto the court, and he found someone to hug, and Valvano, much beloved coach, ended up dying 10 years later of cancer. It's kind of a sad story. Wittenberg did not return calls for any comment, according to a news report. His shot against the Cougars, who earned the nickname Phi Slamma Jamma because of superstars such as Hakeem the Dream Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler, was off the mark. Charles hauled it in and dunked it for the win as the clock ran down. It was pretty interesting stuff if you happen to have watched that game a great number of years ago. According to Charles, his role for the most part was to rebound and defend. He said that in an article in, I believe, in the USA Today, honoring the 25th anniversary of the title. So where was I when I was supposed to be? Challenging for an offensive putback. I was directly under the basket. I could see it was going to be short. I knew I didn't have time to come down and go back up, and I knew Hakeem was somewhere nearby. So I just grabbed the ball and put it in. I looked at the clock, and I watched the last second tick off. It happened so fast, I think it stunned the Houston players. According to Charles, he said, it was still kind of amazing to me that people are still talking about it. He said this on the NC State website. I remember when it first happened, I figured out I had my 15 minutes of fame, and that would be it. I don't really think that was that great Final Four finish that has been played since then. But for some reason, some people just single that out in the game, and they talk about it. Maybe because it was such a David and Goliath thing. And now David is dead. Definitely a sad note there. Too bad. That was a hell of a play he made. And, Houston was heavily favored. They had future NBA Hall of Famers, Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler. At the time they were future Hall of Fame guys. So, just too bad. Anyway, moving on. LT, not worried about lack of PT playing time. Well, Damian Thompson yesterday said he liked the idea going into his 11th NFL season, if they have a season, with the Jets as primarily a third down running back and letting youngster Sean Green take a lot more carries. According to Thompson, he thinks he proved that he can still play and that he's got a lot left. They let me do a lot of the pass catching and the blocking and kind of on third down roll and still be able to take some handoffs. Beating up my body, running through there, taking all the carries, and I can run routes. I've proved that. Thompson, who turned 32 last week, said he feels like he showed last year he could have an important role in his first season with the Jets. Though he had a career low 219 carries, he rushed for 914 yards and 6 touchdowns while catching 52 passes for 368 yards. Pretty good stats, not bad. He isn't sure how much longer he'll play in the NFL, but he might have had a perfect ending had the Jets made it to the Super Bowl last season at nearby Cowboys Stadium. But, hey, he said he was able to taste how close it was. It seemed like a dream ending to a fine career, he said. Didn't work out like that, but at the same time, it lets me know how close I am. I have a heck of a team, a great coaching staff, and I expect us to make another push. So what if the Jets make it this season and he finally gets to play in the Super Bowl? Not to say if we win it this year, I'm going to retire because I probably won't, Thomason said. I don't want to put a limit on when I should stop playing. I think it's a feeling you have, but also I don't want to have that feeling of leaving just a tad bit too early and saying, gosh, I wish I could have kept playing another year or hold on too long. It has to be the right to exit of the game. With the NFL lockout in progress, Thomason has participated in a pair of mini camp-like sessions with his Jet teammates, one in California, another in New Jersey. Obviously, he wants to stay in shape. That's something you definitely want to hear if you're a Jet fan. You know, guys on their own, you know, getting together, trying to stay in shape. I mean, you know, God willing, this strike will end, you know, this lockout will end, and, you know, they can get back to playing some football. But you want your guys to be in the best shape as possible should that happen. Let's talk now. Speaking of the football, let's talk a little bit about the football strike. Now, lately, they've been having meetings and so on and so forth. But the NFL owners and the players plan to resume face to face talks this week, and both sides are still optimistic of reaching a deal by mid July that would save the entire NFL season. But enough significant hurdles remain, particularly over the primary issue of splitting revenue that several named participants in the players' antitrust lawsuit reportedly met with their attorneys in Minneapolis yesterday for what appeared to be a shot across the owner's bow. The idea is the 10 players, the 10 named parties included the Giants, OCU, Unimora, wanted to send the owners the message that they are still intent on pursuing their legal case if the flurry of promising talks over the past month don't produce a collective bargaining agreement. The website Pro Football Talk reported late yesterday the named participants in the lawsuit, who also include Peyton Manning and Drew Brees, are pushing to have themselves exempted from ever receiving the franchise player tag. Such a push is to be poorly, to say the least, poorly received by the owners, particularly the Colts and the Saints, because it would potentially allow Manning and Brees to reach the open market and could throw a serious wrench in the negotiations. Players probably won't need to wait too long for that response. However, because the secretive settlement negotiations are expected to resume as soon as today, with speculation they will be held in Minneapolis, because that is the home of the federal magistrate overseeing the talks. So everybody wants to settle, but so far nobody's settled. Again, millionaires and billionaires fighting over money. Too bad. This time I'm rolling with the millionaires. Players definitely deserve a bigger cut. The NFL is making gobs and gobs of TV money. The owners are just super, super rich. Players were, you know, their time in the league is never that long. Their bodies are banged up. I mean, you know, not everyone plays 10 years or better. You know, running backs, their lifespan is 3 to 5 years. And when you hit 30, it's over. So imagine you worked at a career. If you were a teacher and you could only work until you were 30, you're a has-been at 30. I mean, how good is that? I mean, you would want every benefit and every dollar you could get while you were working. Because once you, well, you know that once you hit 30, that's it. Your job is over. I mean, that's horrible. Just think about that. Once you hit 30, that's it. No more job. Or at least they're already pushing you out the door. Or you don't even get that far because you blow a knee. I mean, it's a tough sport for a reason, and players deserve to be paid rightly so. I mean, I'm taking the players' side, and that's just the bottom line. Anyway, moving on. Tiger not looking too ferocious. I happened to be watching ESPN today when I was at the gym, and I noticed Tiger Woods was on there, and he was talking about how he's not through, and by the way, he's grown this kind of beard, which looks really kind of weird on him. I don't know. I was kind of freaked out by it. But anyway, he was talking about how he's not done. He's not 65. He's 35 and so on and so forth, and kind of commented on the swing that McIlroy had. He's got a pretty swing and whatever. But it seemed like real hollow coming from Tiger, and he looked kind of sickly to me. I don't know. He just didn't – something didn't look right, and it just didn't sound right what he was saying. I don't know. I just wasn't buying it, man. Personally, I've never liked Tiger, and I think that he's done. He may be able to put together a small run, and by small run, I mean maybe put maybe two more championships under his belt. But I really do not believe he's going to – break Jack Nicklaus's record, and he can't be considered a better golfer until he breaks Jack Nicklaus's record. So I just don't see it happening for Tiger. I think it's going to be interesting if he can come back. And right now his timetable is kind of open. He doesn't know when he's going to come back. He's working on his swing and blah blah blah, so on and so forth. But I don't know. I don't think he's that much of a threat anymore. He has to walk the walk now, and I just don't think he's up to it mentally or physically anymore. I think it's finally ground him down. But again, we'll have to wait and see. Moving on to a little bit of baseball. As many of you may or may not know, interleague play is going on between the National League and the American League and Major League Baseball. Now, why is this of interest? It's always cool to see a National League team in an American League park and so on and so forth. And you put these teams together and you have some of these old-time rivalries. And the Yankees went to Chicago. It was definitely cool, good stuff. But when American League teams go on the road for, say, 9 games in a row, it puts them at a great disadvantage. As you know, in the American League, we have what we call the designated hitter. Now, I'm not one ever to take the Red Sox side, but in this case, for the sake of the American League, I'm gonna pony up and take the Red Sox side. David Ortiz has been red hot this season. The Red Sox, now, because of their scheduling, are on the road for 9 games in National League parks, and they're not going to be able to play Big Poppy. He might get 3 or 4 bats over the next 9-10 days, and that can really take a guy out of his rhythm. To me, it's just not fair to the American League teams. I just it's really not fair. You're taking a professional hitter, probably, a designated hitter, you would think he's probably like the best hitter on your team, because that's his job, is just to hit. So you're taking a guy, right out of his game. You're putting him right on the bench because he's in a National League. I think they have to have some kind of conformity. Either you get your DH in all parks or they get rid of the DH. And as you know, the players are never going to let jobs go away. The DH is not going to go away. It's here to stay. Frankly, I like the DH. A lot of people are against it, but I like the DH. I don't care. I like to see a hitter. When I go to a game, I would much rather see a hitter in the batter's box than a pitcher in a batter's box. Pitchers stink. Pitchers throw the ball. They're not supposed to hit the ball. And when a pitcher gets up there at bat, it's like, whatever, right? Go get something to drink or whatever. Or make a phone call or something. I mean, who cares? What is he going to do? Hit a single? I mean, it's not even worth watching. So, I don't know. I think the DH should probably be uniformly throughout the league. And, I think it would cut back on a lot of injuries that pitchers have when they get in there, especially the American League guys. I mean, the Yankees lost Chiming Wong pretty much forever when he was running the bases in Houston. I think he was going from second to third or something, and he was never the same after that. Never the same. You know, I mean, you get guys, you know, on base that aren't supposed to be on base. I mean, you think baseball is a real simple game, but get out there and run the bases sometime and, you know, do this or do that. And believe me, it's a little more difficult than you think. Anyway, I don't know. That's just how I feel. I just think there has to be some more uniformity, and I think the American League is at an extreme disadvantage during this interleague play, especially if you're on the road for 9 games like the Red Sox are, and I believe the Cleveland Indians were also on the road for nine games earlier in the season. It's just not fair, and I think something has to be done about it. But, frankly, I hope the Red Sox lose all their games in the National League, but you know, it's just not fair. And by the way, they're getting beat right now, which is great. Anyway, in closing, I don't believe, speaking of interleague play, I don't think Derek Jeter is going to make an appearance this weekend in the Subway Series. I'm quite sure he really wants to make an appearance. I don't think that calf muscle is going to heal up on time. If you've heard Jimmy Rounds, he's been on every sports show going because he had the same injury as Jeter had, but like 1 degree worse. He's saying that it takes time and he wasn't right until the next year and so on and so forth. I mean, God, if you listen to him, we're not going to see Jeter for another month. But, you know, I don't think that's the case. But I just don't think we're going to see Jeter this weekend during the Subway Series. Now, he's due to come off the DL tomorrow, I believe. But I don't think we're going to see him. I don't think we're going to see him in the Subway Series. And although it would be kind of cool if he did, because he's only like 4 hits away from this 3,000 thing, which is kind of cool. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see like anything else. Anyway, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, especially my partner, Money Mike.
Try
and enjoy some of the holiday weather this weekend. It's supposed to be a nice hot weekend, and enjoy the fireworks. Thanks.
Good night, Woody.
kind of similar. Go to I think oh, it's good. October night's kind of long. Let's see. All you can eat right there.
Okay, we'll do all you can eat for your listening, not your eating pleasure. back, and hopefully we can get some news for you here.
Yeah, I'm hoping to. I'm trying to communicate with my person, my friend.
Leo's getting some help from Blog Talk Radio. He's having a bit of trouble with his computer. He can't get a switchboard up, but fortunately, I have mine up. And I was just thinking about the audio piece that we played for you guys on from Democracy Now, and I was really, really glad that they had that and they went to the trouble to have somebody over there to interview, and because the mainstream media, of course, is paying very little attention to this flotilla going to Gaza, and I'm really upset with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and our approach to this. The government speak on this flotilla to Gaza. After all, I mean, they're under siege. They've been prevented from getting humanitarian support. The country is in desperate condition, and it's simply not fair what's happening. And this flotilla is in the grand tradition of all peace activists to bring attention to a very, very serious problem. And, of course, I'm very interested in this, even more so probably than most people, because I have a friend on the Audacity of Hope who is an activist, and I want her to be safe as well as everyone else that's on that flotilla and on the American boat. And I think these are very courageous people standing up the way Martin Luther King did, the way Mahatma Gandhi did, to create change. It's really the only way that we can create change. And if more people support this and take a stand on it, then change will be created. And it was very interesting to note that in one of the videos, it was mentioned that the problems that they had with apartheid in South Africa, this country supported for many, many years. And Barack Obama was one of the people that was against apartheid, even though the American government supported it. And now he's on the, as what they said, he's on the wrong side of history. And I have to agree with that. And so is Hillary Clinton. I think it's very sad that they don't get with the program, so to speak, to recognize that what's happening over there is a human tragedy of epic proportions and very preventable. And that's what this flotilla is all about, to bring attention to that. I mean, how else can you get any attention to a wrong unless you do something dramatic? And this is dramatic. I mean, the last time there was a flotilla, there were 9 people killed. One of those people killed on that flotilla by Israel was an American citizen. We didn't hear any outrage. There should have been outrage, but there wasn't any. Now they're trying to prevent journalists from even going. I mean, it's just simply not fair and not right and not American, really. Our tradition has always been to have free speech and for people to speak out against wrongs, and now we're trying to prevent people from speaking out against wrongs in the world and to incarcerate them or muffle them by threatening them to be put in prison. I mean, that's absolutely wrong. And people need to understand that it's not American, very un-American. Leo is still working on trying to get his website up here. He can't get his switchboard. For some reason, I'm not sure what's happening to his. I have mine, but he does not have his.
I'm gonna get out of this thing in a second here. Cause
and you'll have to do it after the show is over.
Outstandingly frustrating.
So he'll be right with us in a second, so we can. He has most of our news on his computer. Mine is the standby,
yeah.
So I really can't get into anything. He has it
Sorry
on his.
Sorry about that, folks. Yeah.
So we apologize to you. When the show is over, he will try to get his switchboard updated. So.
It's a joke. This has become a complete joke tonight. Sorry, folks. But anyway, we're going to go to another thing else here.
Here we go.
Get rid of that nightmare. Okay. Work on it another day, like somebody said that.
All right. Oh, I'm very interested in
this. This is our health segment here tonight, and we wanted to talk about some stuff on the nuclear disasters here recently.
But here's the positive thing that you can do.
Yeah.
Let's go to the article. Meditation can cut heart attacks by as much as half. I think that's wonderful.
Oh, sorry, we cannot find this page. Yeah, okay, Telegraph. Unless we hear the fools of the mist.
Okay.
Okay.
But this is what the article said. The practice, which involves continual repeating of a mantra, was found to reduce high blood pressure, cholesterol, thickening of the arteries. It also protects against diabetes. This is a seminal finding, said Dr. Norman Rosenthal of the American National Institute of Mental Health. The prevention of heart attacks and strokes and actual lengthening of a lifespan by an alternative treatment method is extremely rare, if not unprecedented. If transcendental meditation were a drug conferring so many benefits, it would be a billion-dollar blockbuster. And that's probably why we can't find the article.
Probably
that pharmaceuticals probably don't like the fact that you don't need drugs, you just need to meditate. That's why those yogis live so long. 100 years or more.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, good.
We're going into a cashless society. That's also quite an interesting article.
Yeah.
McCain and Kerry open up Cairo Stock Exchange. How convenient.
I think I can get some. There's a video here. I think there's some decent audio on it. I'm not positive, but.
Former U.S. presidential candidates John McCain and John Kerry visit the Egyptian Stock Exchange. The senators on a two-day visit to Egypt were accompanied by senior American business leaders. They were greeted by Egyptian Stock Exchange head Mohammed Abdesalam. Republican McCain and Democrat Kerry were invited to ring the opening bell. Both expressed their belief in a democratic and free Egypt.
It is in the United States' national security interest to see a prosperous, growing, democratic, and free Egypt.
But we are both extraordinarily committed to what is happening here in Egypt. We have great respect and admiration for the changes that you are fighting for.
The group arrived in Cairo on Saturday, where they made a visit to the iconic Tahrir Square. They also met with Egypt's interim Prime Minister, Essam Sharaf, and Finance Minister, Samir Radwan. The pair are expected to announce the results of their talks with Egypt's top leaders at a news conference. Sunita Rapai, Reuters.
The interesting thing here isn't so much that they went there, but what's interesting is this, is who they went with. As terrifying as any biblical plague, the very corporations that funded the think tanks and media organizations that crafted and sold the entire engineered Arab Spring hoax to the world have finally swarmed into Egypt to settle in and strip its lands clean. U.S. Senator John McCain recently led a delegation representing his true constituency, Fortune 500 corporations, to Egypt and Tunisia to promote private sector growth. Traveling with McCain was a collection of corporate parasites from General Electric, Boeing, Coca-Cola, Bechtel, ExxonMobil, Marriott, and Dow, who surveyed Cairo like conquering despots.
Oh, God.
Yeah, thought that was really, really interesting. And
The New York Times reported of the trip, Senator McCain and Arizona Republican and Senator John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, who are visiting Egypt with the American business delegation, that it was in the interest of the United States national security to see Egypt become a free and democratic country. McCain would also say, we also suggested ways to have more economic cooperation, further assistance to Egypt's military, and hastening the legislation of proposed aid to the Congress. While many labor under the corporate media-fueled delusion that the United States was caught off guard by the Arab Spring and has shifted into a reactionary or opportunistic mode, an earlier New York Times article entitled U.S. Groups Help Nurture Arab Uprising reveals that the United States government has been funding training and preparing for the Middle East unrest since as early as 2008. Such funding and training preparations were done through organizations such as the National Endowment for Democracy, which in turn funds the International Republican Institute, the National Democrat Institute, and Freedom House. Understanding that John McCain is chairman of the IRI, which helped unseat the government in the very countries he is now touring with big business by his side, illustrates a complete picture, start to finish, of modern imperialism in action.
Yep. And the article is quite long, and it goes on, but I think it says enough. These guys are...
swarm of locusts.
Yeah. And this one rather frightened me today when I saw it, and it's been in the news, but this is the latest. Loconcho's fire, the mandatory evacuation for Los Alamos Laboratory.
That's
and,
a little bit scary.
Yeah, the fire is getting very close there, and there's a lot of nuclear stuff there. Of course, they're not going to be able to find that one, I'll bet you.
See if we can find this article that comes up.
Maybe. Yeah, there we go. Wonderful. Okay, fire crews have contained a spot fire that started in a remote area of Los Alamos National Laboratory. Emergency officials say that La Concha's fire, which has burned into the southern edge of New Mexico, State Route 4 at the lab's southwest boundary, crossed the road to the north early this afternoon. Air crews dumped water at the site with Lab Technical Area 49 and brought the blaze under control. The area had been thinned of ground fuels in recent years. About 1 acre burned, and the lab has detected no off-site facilities face immediate threat. And all the nuclear and hazardous materials are accounted for and protected. Environmental sites are being monitored, and air quality experts are conducting or coordinating with the U.S. Environmental Protection. Las Conchas fire has burned an estimated 49,000 acres in forest canyons in Mesa South and west of the lab. The lab will remain closed on Tuesday, which is today, and is supporting Los Alamos County as it conducted a staged mandatory evacuation of the town site. Los Alamos County residents should tune in to 16:10 a.m. for updated information. A joint information center has been established as a regional development corporation, Santa Fe. Mm. So stay tuned for that. This was from the
and today, updated at 10:15 p.m., the La Concha's fire at an estimated 44,000 acres entered Los Alamos National Laboratory property and is still at zero pre-contained. Evacuation is now mandatory for Los Alamos.
Yeah, it says evacs are still voluntary for White Rock, but Los Alamos evacuees are instructed not to relocate to White Rock in case it's evacuated too. So, just to know. Interesting. And boy, we are so efficient here at the LA School Show.
A Pfizer drug test kills 11 children in Nigeria. This is
I wanted to do
sad.
That. I had that listed as one I wanted to do. And the other one I wanted to read here is Enter the Dragon to Save Euro, which is China's buying up all Euro So it's interesting. But this is a drug test. Pfizer is being sued. But this is really a piece of work. I'll tell you, Pfizer is a piece of work.
The last hurdle of a decade-long compensation claim battle. 17-year-old Shanthu undergoes a DNA test to prove he's a victim of a failed drug trial by the pharmaceutical company Pfizer that happened 15 years ago in Kano State, Nigeria. 11 children were killed and several more injured when Pfizer tested out a drug called Trovan on 200 children. The drug was supposed to treat a deadly regional outbreak of meningitis. Pfizer agreed to pay $75 million in compensation in 2009, but they introduced DNA testing as part of the process for qualifying for the payment. Back at home, survivors like Shamsu, who was crippled, and their families feel the DNA test is designed to deny them of the compensation money. Many say they've already provided Pfizer with documents proving their children were part of the trial.
In the claimant form we filled, they stated clearly that only when we undergo a DNA test, they will pay the compensation.
Pfizer, which denied all wrongdoing, even though it's agreed to pay out $75 million, says the DNA test is designed to guard against fraudulent claims.
As we're talking, we have about we've collected samples from 547 people, and only 200 people participated in the study. So what do we do?
But many of the victims are poor and illiterate. They don't understand what DNA testing is and fear it's another attempt by Pfizer to make them guinea pigs in a new drug trial. Some victims abandoned their claims when DNA testing was introduced as a condition of receiving payment. Some of the compensation money released by Pfizer has gone into building this $25 million medical research and disease control center. The hope is that one day locals will be able to deal with things like outbreaks of disease and medical epidemics themselves. It may go some way to healing the wounds of Pfizer's experiment and benefit the survivors who are simply too afraid to go for DNA testing. Yvonne Dege, Al Jazeera, Kano State in northern Nigeria.
Frightening videos, by the way, on this one. But you can check this on YouTube. A Pfizer drug test kills 11 children in Nigeria. And, hold on 1 second.
Okay. Enter the dragon to save the euro. That's also that China's buying up the euro. Genetic modification gone wild. 10 signs that our world may be destined to reassemble. A really bad science fiction movie.
Did you know that today's scientists are actually producing mice that I passed on this one today. I don't know if this is like real or not real. It had
a ring to it.
Oh, anything you've ever said on the internet could be seen by employers as feds approve a firm that dishes dirt on applicants. This is interesting because people are going to start, they're trying to implement this group, for-profit group, that's going to, dig all the kinds of crap about you on the internet. Potential employers. Federal Trade Commission has approved a controversial firm that scours social media sites to check on job applicants. It means anything you've ever said in public on sites including Facebook, Twitter, and even Craigslist could be seen by your would-be employer. The Washington-based commission has ruled the firm Social Intelligence Corporation complies with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, even though it keeps the results of its searches on file for 7 years. All right, this is like, I'm telling you, we're doomed, folks.
The company keeps information. Go ahead, go up there.
You
didn't read all of it.
Yeah, results for the search for 7 years.
Yeah, but there's others. There's other things.
I read
things.
That. I read this. This
okay.
is what I read.
It'll become part of your job application.
Yeah, it raises the frightening prospect of any social media posting, even if it's years old, or was meant as a joke, being used in background checks. Applicants who use online pseudonyms aren't safe either. The firm uses special software to link those named nicknames with real offline names known to employers.
One applicant found himself out of the running for a job after being branded racist because he once joined a Facebook group called I Shouldn't Have to Press 1 for English. We are in the United States. Learn the language. Social intelligence corporations scours everything from social networking sites such as Facebook to video and picture sharing websites as well as blogs and wikis. The company has defended its policy of keeping the searches on file, saying it's for compliance reasons only. It says the negative findings are not reused if a new employer runs a check on applicant. Its chief operating officer, Jeffrey Andrews, said we are not building a database on individuals that will be evaluated each time they apply for a job and potentially could be used adversely even if they have cleaned up their profiles.
One of the reports released on Forbes magazine flagged an applicant for demonstrating potentially violent behavior because he posted a photograph of him holding a gun on his Facebook account. Another was flagged for illegal activity after putting an advert on advertisement on Craigslist searching for the drug OxyContin. So far, the company says that it's found negative online postings in up to 20% of the applicants it's been asked to investigate, up to 20%. So in other words, 80% are they've found negative shit on. Social Intelligence Corps was founded a year ago, and soon afterward, the Federal Trade Commission began investigating over fears it could be in breach of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But the government has now dropped its inquiry, ruling the company is within the rules as long as it lets applicants know whether they failed to get a job as a result of their report. It also changes the wording on its permission form, which all applicants must sign before the check are carried out, to make sure they know exactly what will be checked out during the review. Social Intelligence Corp says its reports are fairer than its employers' Simply Google candidates.
Mm-hmm.
The reports also take into account job-threatening characteristics such as criminal activity and others not included. Personal information such as sexuality or religion, which an employee legally cannot see. Applicants can also dispute the report's findings and the offending word if deleted is found to be correct, incorrect, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, they got to dig up the dirt on you. They got to sell it all out.
Yep.
No matter what the hell they tell you.
You got to be very careful on those social media things.
Yeah.
Social networks.
I'm way beyond that now.
Well, I wouldn't get on it for that reason.
You're on it now. What are you kidding?
No, I'm not on Facebook.
You're right here. You're talking.
Right, but I'm not on Facebook.
I got your face up there with me.
I'm not on it myself personally.
No, not as a Facebook
person.
Babe.
No, and I don't post anything either.
But I got your face up there with Gail. Now you're notorious. Wanted by the Israelis. No. But anyway. Let's see. We got 5 more minutes.
Yep.
That's Bernanke thing. I really got lost on this.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. We'll listen to a little bit of it, but I kind of got lost.
In the global economic collapse.
Yeah.
See what he said.
Well, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, let me run it for a minute or so.
globalresearch.ca. And now, for the real news. World markets experienced dramatic losses and rebounds last week as investors watched economic developments in Greece with growing anxiety. The jitters come after weeks of gathering turmoil in the Eurozone, starting earlier this month when credit rating agency Moody's Investor Service downgraded Greek debt to Caa1 and indicated a 50% chance that the country would default on its bonds. Just 2 weeks ago, Standard & Poor responded by downgrading Greek debt to CCC, giving it the lowest credit rating for any country in the world. One fear is that the contagion of a Greek default would spread throughout the Eurozone. borrowing rates for other fragile European economies in Ireland and Portugal to skyrocket. A Portugal default would be a massive hit to the Spanish banking system, which has the largest exposure to Portuguese debt in the Eurozone. Now Moody's has threatened to downgrade the creditworthiness of some of the largest Italian banks and has put the Italian public debt on review for downgrade. The EU and the IMF have scrambled to throw together a second massive bailout for the tiny Greek nation, this one expected to be worth 120 billion euros, with 12 billion euros of those funds to be dispersed early next month. The Greek parliament will have to vote this week on whether or not to accept the package, which contains another round of punishing austerity measures as conditions for the funds.
I forgot this was Corbett's thing, but
the Greeks are really being dragged over the coals.
There's a section on Bernanke, and that's rather interesting. So
we just have 2 minutes.
Let me just finish with this one. I think.
Look who's buying up the flood-ravaged land. That's quite an article.
Yeah, if I can get back to it. Finalist one under Now It All Makes Sense. A Missouri farming and ranching contract just got off a conference call wherein he was informed that the federal government is sending out letters to all the flooded out farmers in the Missouri River floodplain and bottoms, notifying them that the Army Corps of Engineers will offer to buy their land. Intentionally flood in massive acreage of highly productive farmland. Destroys people's communities and homes. Catch them while they are desperate and afraid, and then swoop in and buy the ground cheap. Those evil sons of bitches. Right.
And sell it to a corporation for nothing.
Yeah, sure.
Taxpayers buy it, and then you turn it over to Monsanto.
Stolen by the government.
Yeah.
Not even a fair price. Okay, let me get here. Speaking of evil sons of bitches, George Soros appears to be investing in farm ground through the same puppet company that he used to get into the grain elevator and fertilizer business. The company is called Osprey Capital Management and is buying up farm ground in a joint venture with Tays River Investment as a partner. Here is that announcement. It says, okay, here's the connection. The Osprey outfit was a hedge fund specializing commodities that was started and run by some cocky child who didn't know how to trade bear markets and got his butt kicked into next week in a grain market of 2008. He also lost a fortune trying to trade rare earth metals. In fact, it was so bad that he had to shut his fund down because he had promised his investors that he would give them all their investment money back if the fund lost more than 30% in 1 year. Whoopsie. But it appears that Soros swooped in and saved the day because the Osprey is the co-investor with Soros that bought the remnants of Kong Agra's trading operation and renamed it Gavilon. In the industry, it is widely acknowledged that Osprey is Soros, and the three-page article citation is here. Copy and paste the URL to your address. And it says, as you probably remember, Gavilon just recently bought both. I don't remember any of this. But what's happening is these hedge funds are buying up land. Yeah. And now the Army Corps of Engineers. It's interesting. The Army Corps of Engineers, in collusion with Marxist environmentalists, have engineered a flood scenario that already has killed people and will result in property damage in the multi-billions of dollars, and it is all intentional. Read the purposeful flooding of American heartland here at AmericanThinker.com. All right, and the excuse is saving the wetland habitat of the blue-butted water auk, or some Taurus filmus like that. Two points. I'll say that no one else will about the Army Corps of Engineers. I'll say what no one else will about the Army Corps of Engineers, that we're all at the C-State School Engineering Students set up. Let that reality compound over 30, 40 years, and you would be far better off letting Terrytown at the local machining shop or Ricky over at the diesel garage run the Missouri River dam system.
Well, people can go to that if they...
So, yeah, and Gulag notes from Ireland. But
we've come to the end of, we've come to the end
very,
of our
very
show.
Very good article. Gulag Bound, it's from. So I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I hope we gave you enough to think about, for sure.
And hopefully we will be able to figure out his Blog Talk switchboard problem
maybe,
tonight.
Yeah, maybe they'll figure this thing out. But in the meantime, I want to thank everybody who joined us.
Yeah. And have a good night, folks, and stay tuned tomorrow night for a little more news. And
we want to get going here.
So we'll play our
end
music. And
good night.
Thanks for being with us. Good night, folks.
Join us tomorrow.